Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program and the second part of my interview with Chaz and Marco Salmon. We start by talking about the people of Mamfungano Island on Lake Victoria in Kenya. How are the people that you are close to in Mufungano?
Mufungano Island, yeah.
Yeah, can you tell that story and talk about that a little
bit? Sure. Thank you. Yeah, this was also a challenging year. You know, it's the first year no one's been able to travel from the U.S. We normally have a group of medical students and public health students that travel, you know, throughout the year and often, you know, a larger group in the summer. So that had to be postponed and changed. And I had a lot of anxiety at the beginning that kind of like right when we were needed there, we weren't going to be able to really support that very vulnerable community. But also was just very encouraged by leaders that stepped up there in the community. Support from partners like the Sunset Rotary Club in Glenwood Springs came through again when we needed to rebuild our emergency boat, which is currently serving as the only COVID transportation service for that entire population of 30,000 people in Lake Victoria. We were able to get them PPE, so they got masks, and we did a large radio program on COVID awareness. So even though we weren't be able to be there in person, I think we had a real showing of solidarity to help them prepare for what's coming in Kenya, which I think the COVID epidemic or pandemic is just starting to really hit in Kenya now. It was kind of really their first wave is kind of starting now.
The two of you take me and the listeners back to how that relationship started.
That work began during my anthropology field work as a graduate student in Kenya in 2007. And then through that work, we started a nonprofit, which is based in Glenwood Springs. Got help from folks like Bob Noon, who helped us put together our charter. And Gus Lundeen has been our treasurer and taking care of all of our taxes since we started. And lots of support from the community in Glenwood, Rotary Clubs and other folks that have helped us build this community center on this remote island. And yeah, it's been over 10 years we've served this population through various different health and education and nutrition programs. And yeah, we're finally entering a phase really this year, I think, has helped us do that, to say this organization there is really ready to stand on its own. And we're kind of changing our model too, less kind of directing and managing things from the United States to really, you know, kind of supporting them as advisors, but letting them now drive their organization on their own. And I think this year kind of necessitated that. We've seen, wow, they're ready and they did it. And we've kind of gone with that transition in a positive way.
Oh, that's great. Self-sufficiency. Marco, talk about how that experience has impacted your life and your work.
That's been another really special way, I think, that Chaz and I have been able to kind of find synergy in our lives and be together at times. My involvement there was certainly drawn because Chaz invited me to come there on Mufungano Island. And once I was there for part of the summer, also got to experience how special of a place that was and the really kind of sincere and genuine community connections that he had initially forged, which then extended nearly instantly to all of Chaz's family, including, you know, parents and siblings and any relative at all.
Well, that's the tribe you come from. That's a big tribe. The Rhynish Salmon tribe is vast.
Yep. So I was, I think immediately when I saw that, and I think, you know, we call that global health when you work in some other spot, but really it has been, it's more local health. It's local health just in a much different geographic area. And I think that experience was really fulfilling and important to just begin to see many of the ways, all of the different things that affect health that are beyond the clinic walls or in a place where there are no clinic walls. And so I think then bringing that back, I was able to continue to, you know, be involved and experience things in Mufungano during my medical school in Colorado. Specifically then I remember one of the summers, I think this was right before you had to decide what specialty you're going into, when I spent, I think, much of the summer there with Chaz. And there were just a number of emergencies that happened. I think, you know, like, what did we see? Like scorpion bites, and one of our friend's kids broke his arm and had to be set there. And I,
I think didn't Alija's mom, Mark, didn't you sew up like a, you sewed up a machete wound that summer, I remember.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Firewood injury. Or, and that I think propelled me a little bit to emergency medicine and the draw to gain some additional experience and training in that. And then was able to kind of continue as I gained some expertise, to be able to contribute that back to the effort in Kenya through some advising of our emergency boat and kind of the, we call it a health navigation, being able to have community volunteers help navigate people through emergencies, both physically through travel and logistically through kind of a follow-up and things.
Wow. Talk to me about the influences in your life. I know your parents have both been strong influences. Can you speak to that? I mean, I know there are others, but I know that they're profound in your life and the impact that they've had.
Throughout this year, I've been talking with my dad, Marco, too often. Kind of similarly, just kind of comparing notes on how we're dealing with COVID, what we're hearing, how we're staying safe. So I think having just my brother and my dad to quickly get on the phone and check in with has been, yeah, that's helped me get through this day to day. I've definitely had moments this year where, yeah, I feel my mom.
Yeah, you lost your mom almost 2 years ago now, right?
Yeah, coming up on February 15th here. Yeah, definitely feel her presence. And I think her end-of-life experience, I think, has definitely impacted the way I practice medicine. And I think given me a lot of perspective, particularly with patients with serious chronic and terminal illnesses, of which COVID has made things very challenging. But I think that that's given me some insight and to help guide them through that maze. That's from her, kind of her example and her guidance with her, the way she faced, you know, her challenges with terminal breast cancer.
What part of your mother is in your DNA that you carry with you every day?
I mean, I think her sense of humor, I think her honest, she just was very just called, said things, just was straightforward about what was what. And I think her ability just to kind of, her radical acceptance of like, this is what's happening, you know,
yeah,
embrace it. This is it. This is what's happening and you can't do anything about it. And you might as well figure out how to find meaning in it.
She taught us all. Oh yeah.
Yeah. She used to call that, you know, she would always call that plan B or about accepting plan B. And I think that this year when the entire world has had to adjust to plan B, it made me think about that a lot. And we've wondered so much about how my mom would handle things and all of the changes that COVID had brought. And I think part of that is interesting to imagine, but I can also just imagine the grace that she would find in accepting these different changes and being flexible. And I think what we're asked to do in our life currently, in, you know, anyone trying to run a business has to be flexible. And especially in medicine right now, I think the amount of changes and flexibility are just intense. And so I think that's a trait that I've tried to remember from my mom and exemplify.
What about your pop?
Well,
yeah. And I think from my dad too, you know, he is someone who has always just shown us the amazing value that comes from knowing someone, knowing people over a long term and connecting with them in long-term ways as their physician and as their community member. And beyond just the exact medicine that you give to people, I mean, hearing from him part of this summer of how helping families navigate what COVID means for their lives, you know, what changes that you have to make to stay safe and yet stay sane at the same time. I think trying to remember to treat, you know, beyond just organ systems of the body is something that I think my dad has taught me and I try to remember and use. And then I also, I've been thinking a little bit recently, the other person is also my Aunt Katie, my mom's sister, is a remarkable person who continues to be an activist in her life in ways that I think taught my mom and continue to teach us. This summer is no exception. She also donated a kidney earlier, a couple of years ago, to someone, to a random, not someone she knows. And so I think her giving spirit is an inspiration.
Yeah, alongside my dad, who's obviously been a mentor and someone that has kind of been a guide throughout this kind of journey of medicine. I think someone that's been really important to me is Brian Murphy at Valley View. Brian actually was at Duke University when we were there at Duke, and I worked as a research assistant for Brian for 2 summers, long before I knew medicine was really where I wanted to head. And yeah, just getting his perspective and kind of his encouragement right at the start of that journey, and then throughout, he's just been such an encouraging person in my life and in my clinical career. And I think our community is really fortunate to have him at the helm of Valley View during this incredibly challenging time. So he's definitely been someone that's been really inspirational to me throughout my career. And yeah, wanted to acknowledge as well.
Jazz. And he's a Duke basketball fan rather than a Carolina Tar Heel, which helps.
Yeah, good Blue Devil basketball.
You guys and your Duke roots, that goes way back. Jazz, what do you carry in your DNA from your dad?
Yeah, you know, I think that humility and that ability to, take time to really get to know people. I think, like Marco was saying, from my experiences, just seeing the way my dad practices medicine, I had a brief chance to practice with him a little bit when my mom was sick and I came home for a few months. Seeing the way his practice works, he just really takes time to understand his patients and kind of travel with them on their journeys. And I think it is easy to get focused on the various numbers and the diagnoses that people have. And I think you have to have a high level of competency to kind of give people good advice in clinical care with those things. But it's not sufficient to practice medicine at the highest level. And I think my dad's really shown me, the ability to really connect with families and individuals over a long period of time. I'm very grateful the way he's shown us how to do that.
Marco?
Yeah, and I think what I see that come out for Chaz and I almost call it like patient ownership, and I don't mean that in the sense of you owning them, but you have a responsibility for them. And I think Chaz and I see, because we are embedded in medicine, how people can get shuffled around, lost within our system with no one truly taking responsibility or ownership for their care, for their path, for what happened. And I think a practice of Chaz and I's that I think is a credit to my dad is that when they're your patients, and it comes with like a deep, deep sense of responsibility to make sure that it goes as best that it can for them. And you doing the extra mile that you need to, you not just making a referral, but making sure that it's a good referral, that it's acted upon, or that things actually happen for them. And that sense goes a long way for patients, I think. And without it, I think people can get a little bit lost.
Well, that empathy that some doctors don't have, you know, as a patient, mm-hmm. I can tell. And as your dad's patient, I know what you're talking about, his compassion. He takes time. He's empathetic. And I've been dealt with by others who didn't have that. They had the clinical stuff mm-hmm. down. You know, they'd been to school, but somehow they missed the, what we call a bedside manner, you know. Patients mm-hmm. know when they're, when that's missing. So,
and I think there's kind of, I think there is a time and place for all of that. You know, I think I've seen, you know, like this year, I have been so grateful for some of like the critical care doctors in our hospital who, just based on volume and the things that they're dealing with this year, I know they don't have time to sit and chat with every family member. But they have that deep expertise in critical care that has kept people alive. And that's where I've kind of come to value, like, this is a team sport. Like, that's a way that I can support that patient, is helping explain what's going on with the family and let the critical care docs do what they need to do. You know, like, I think that as I kind of travel through medicine too, I see that not everybody needs the same skill set.
Right.
And so I think that there's like different roles we can play. And I think that I'm seeing that. Yeah. I'm probably not the like the master clinician that I know that other physicians I've worked with are. I've seen that. But I think kind of where I can really try and lean in is some of those things I've learned from, people like my mom and dad, was to try and connect with the patient. And that together, that creates a really important, atmosphere of clinical care.
You know, and also this summer, and sorry, this fall, we're not summer anymore, it's snowing. I think, obviously people know that the medical world has had a big toll on it, and people they talk more and more about, burnout and resiliency for healthcare providers. Having read a little bit about that, I think there used to be a concern that if you were too connected to your patient or cared, you were more susceptible or vulnerable to burnout. But I read something this fall that impacted me, how actually it is those who are able to express empathy and actually have the, greatest levels of empathy have a degree of protection, because then instead of just kind of being surrounded by such a sad milieu of clinical outcomes and such, instead you have actually deep connection, even if some of those are patients who pass away or family members who are affected by people passing away. But I think that practice of empathy and of connection is actually like beneficial for a personal way and for being able to continue the work that we're doing.
Well, and you both do it because you have a deep connection to people. I mean, it's important to have that connection. How have the patients supported you through these rough times? How have they buoyed you up?
I remember telling Marco, I've been feeling like, I've been amazed at how brave people are. Like on our COVID units, and multiple times there have been periods when, you can't really have any visitors. And I put myself in someone's shoes thinking about how scared I would be in the hospital with anybody else that I know.
Right.
But by and large, I feel like, yes, people have been frightened and are anxious, but I've been so amazed with the courage of some of my patients that just like, facing this challenging situation, getting their family members on the phone to make decisions. It's kind of inspired me to say, gosh, if this person, sick older people, people in their 80s and 90s dealing with COVID, knowing that this could be really serious for them, but still laughing and joking with the nurses. And, I've kind of said, gosh, if this old lady can do it, I can do that. I've been really impressed with the humor that people have brought to this situation that, makes me think, all right, if that person with facing those challenges and those illnesses can face this with courage, I can put on my mask and do it too.
Yeah, and I just have felt how the impact of a simple thank you and simple acts of gratitude, I hope they feel good to the patient who is doing those, but a thank you from someone in the emergency department is frequently unexpected, or it's not all that common, and to hear that a couple of times goes a long way. And then I had just one that impacted me right after the end of a long, it was like a half overnight. So I think I walked out of the hospital at 3 a.m. and someone had left just a thank you card on my car. I think just knowing that it was the employee parking lot with a little like a coffee gift receipt.
Wow.
Or a gift card, and just an anonymous thank you for doing what you do. So it reminds me that saying thank you to people, it just helps everybody's day.
After our interview, Marco went on to pack for Glenwood Springs, and Chaz went in for another shift at North Memorial. During his shift, Chaz thought about some things that he had forgotten to say and wondered if there would be a place where they would fit. They definitely do, and here he is.
Thanks again for giving me a chance to share a few additional thoughts. Yeah, I was grateful for our interview, and headed right into my shift at North, and kind of enjoyed having a chance to just, reflect on our conversation while I was working again. But realized kind of immediately that this experience of being a, quote unquote, frontline worker, kind of what it means to be on the front line, it's been a privilege in many ways. As I was saying, it's added so much meaning to kind of my role as a provider.
Right.
And I think a lot of kind of strength and encouragement to kind of wear that badge and get that, kind of collective credibility and inspiration from people. But I also just kind of realized again, as I was going about my shift, like how many different people are serving on the front lines in our communities, you know, in particular, even just in the hospital, thinking about my role as a physician and along with so many other people that are part of this team in the hospital. I think it's been easy for us as physicians to kind of see our roles acknowledged. I don't think we ever worried that when, you know, masks were being distributed, that we'd be the ones to get them, or when the vaccine came around, that our names would be on the list. But I think about the people in the hospital that I work with that have leaned into this in ways that even for me as a provider, I'm continually awed by.
Yeah, you couldn't do it at all if all those other things weren't in place. If the room wasn't cleaned and stuff wasn't picked up and meals weren't served.
Yeah, not only couldn't do it, but like they do the work of caring for patients. I mean, other people are doing the work of caring for patients in the hospital. Yeah. You know, my role is to, you know, I interview someone, I examine them, I talk with them and understand, try and explain what we think is going on. And then I get to do a lot of my work back at my computer, reviewing labs and adjusting medications and, you know, reviewing it, studies and, you know, imaging reports. But the actual work of caring for patients, my nursing colleagues and the physical therapists and the respiratory therapists and the nutritionists and the custodial staff and the hospitality services that make the hospital work, the social workers, you know, and especially this year, it's made me realize just how much proximity, like physical proximity they have to patients, particularly when we're talking about an infectious disease where we're supposed to stand 6 feet back. You know, as a provider, I can do much of what I need to do other than an exam, standing, you know, sitting in a chair 6 feet back from the patient, just chatting with them. But my colleagues are there feeding patients and putting in IVs and cleaning them up and helping them breathe. And so I've been awed by their courage, and particularly in the beginning when it felt really overwhelming. Just felt very awed by the nurses and the phlebotomists and the people that just went right into those rooms. And this was even before we had N95s. And we're just smiling and laughing and reassuring people. So I think sometimes in medicine, I think it's easy for those of us with the biggest paychecks to feel like we have the biggest roles. But I went through my next shift after we talked last, just again remembering that there are so many people that have leaned into this. And as soon as I take a step outside of the hospital, I look at the other people that have kept our communities working.
Yeah.
You know, the people in our, you know, municipal governments and all the different services that we rely on, transportation. And I look at teachers, look at what we've asked teachers to do.
It's been really hard on them.
Oh, and I think that in healthcare, at least we've gotten that. I mean, I look at, frontline services, our first responders and the challenges that our firefighters and police departments and that so many people have faced. I think that at least in medicine, we've gotten this kind of consistent jolt of like, you guys are on the front lines. We're all here behind you. That has been huge for us. But it definitely made reminded me that there are so many people leaning in and that I'm so grateful to them, and I'm grateful for the support I received. And I just wanted to make sure that I took a minute to pass that forward too, because wow, if people made sacrifices that it's hard for me to even fathom.
Thanks for that. You also wanted to talk about your friends, basically your extended family in Mofungano Island.
Yeah. You know, you had mentioned right at the end of our conversation, about our Torchbearers project, which I think bears many similarities to what you've been trying to accomplish with Immigrant Stories. But essentially our team in Kenya, we received a small grant from National Geographic Society to try and document the oral histories of this indigenous community in Lake Victoria that speaks an endangered language called Suba, and to try and capture and create a radio documentary for our little local radio station that we broadcast from the Ikeala Kiona Community Center, to capture their oral history of migration from Uganda about 250 years ago. This really fascinating oral history that spans, you know, 12 generations, that we kind of realized, you know, we started this project before COVID hit, but became even more important once COVID became a reality, because knowing that once these elders in this community were gone, these stories were going with them.
What's the radio station? Is it, what are the call letters for the radio station? Does it have such?
It's called EKFM.
EKFM. Can people access it on online, or is,
you know,
it...
you can see, I don't know if at the moment we have the capability to stream, but I know that's something the radio station's been working on. But you can see and learn more about the radio station at our organization's website at organichealthresponse.org.
All one word, organichealthresponse.org. Yes.
And also the University of Minnesota Center for Global Health and Social Responsibility has posted a number of stories about this radio initiative.
How can people access that site?
It's globalhealthcenter.umn.edu. You know, I think as we were just talking about, you were saying what a privilege it's been to kind of document some of these oral histories, particularly stories of migration.
Yeah, it's been a great gift in my life, you know, to meet these people and see the strength of in their persistence and their faith that they've come to a better place.
That for me, I just resonated with me. And I feel like, you know, in the last 10 years in Kenya, we've had a chance to do a number of different research studies looking at HIV interventions and nutrition interventions. And we're doing a large study right now looking at maternal health with our emergency boat and helping women dealing with obstetrical emergencies. Those projects have been, you know, feel so important. But man, this particular effort to try and document these vanishing oral histories has felt like the most important work we've undertaken yet. And we had this, you know, it's so interesting as we talk about these days with like truth in the media and what's stories are real and what's our sources reliable and how to fact check things. And we went around the island and met with, you know, these elders that were recounting stories that had literally been passed down, never written down orally since, you know, 250 years ago. This incredible story of an assassination of one of the 26th king of the Ugandan clan, and this mass exodus that happened in the wake of that, this kind of intertribal war. And then we, with a group of elders and youth radio broadcasters, they went back, we traveled back to Uganda, retracing this history and meeting with people in these different communities. And they actually met with family members of this royal dynasty in Uganda. And after 200 years of separation, they were telling the same story.
Yeah, amazing.
Which had never been written down. Which just like raised, you know, goosebumps on to me just to think about, you know, kind of the way we sometimes feel like unless it's written down and documented in certain ways, it can't be real.
Yeah.
That how valuable these stories of migration are, that people would tell them accurately for hundreds of years.
Well, I would like to partner with you and the folks there sometime to maybe we could share some of those stories with locals.
That would be, I bet that would be a project that the radio team on Fingana would be really excited about. But yeah, that was great to go into my next shift thinking about some of these things, because again, I think we're used to just putting our heads down. I appreciate the opportunity just to reflect a little bit about it. I guess the last thing, Walt, that I wanted to add is, one big gratitude to my biggest support too, which has been my wife through all this. And the parents that have also leaned into the sacrifices that this pandemic has brought. While that has been a source of daily support and encouragement that I think also goes under-recognized sometimes in the final tallies is just...
Not sometimes, most of the time, huh, Chaz? I mean, the women, the mothers and wives and the work that they do so that other things get done. I mean, it's been a real strain on mothers to try to figure out how to be suddenly teachers again, you know?
I think the rug got pulled out from so many professional and dedicated people that suddenly had just somehow figured out a way to piece together a way to manage family and professional work-life balance.
Yeah.
That just collapsed when we suddenly said, no, we need, you know, kids are going to be at home. And I think that has fallen on are the mothers in our lives. And I'm so grateful for the way that they have, at least the mothers in my life, have been there for my family.
Yeah. You are your mother.
As always, yeah.
Yeah, man.
Always.
So Nancy Ray.
Yeah. Miss her a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks, Walt. This has been a cool experience, and I think I'll be really grateful. Yeah, when we look back on what this period has meant, to know that you documented it for your show and your column. So thank you.
It was a gift for me, and a privilege and a pleasure to sit with you guys.
Thanks, man. Right on. Love you lots.